This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
I can just say a couple of words before our mission begins. It's an absolute joy and pleasure to welcome her to the Austin Zen Center, where she has not visited for about a decade. Mission has a very long practice history, currently in Berkeley, where she kind of began in our lineage. She is a Dharma heir of my Dharma grandfather, Sojourner Mel Weitzman. He was a carpenter, and he made these kotsu, these teaching sticks. Not this one, it's not from Mel, but Andrea's is. And it was a Tassajara for a number of years, I gather, and then he gave it to her, saying her old friends, and I'm so glad she could come.
What a warm-hearted welcome I've had here in Austin. I just feel the strength and the connectedness of the practice here. So I'm very heartened to be back for the first time since I made a pilgrimage to different Zen centers a little over a decade ago that included San Antonio, Austin, and Houston. And you know, it was last, Chara and I have a long connection since her original temple was a temple that was started also by one of Sojourner's Dharma heirs, Pat Phelan, Joshu Pat Phelan. And we have long had conversations, and it was in last September that we incubated the idea of this talk around the installation, the coming installation and dedication of the Jiso Garden here, the beautiful Jiso that you have in your developing garden. And so this talk is a continuation of an introduction to who Jiso is and how Jiso functions in our lives. We gave this talk a title a little while ago, something like The Heart of Jiso's Wisdom, but as I was working on it the other day, I thought, well, really, it's like Jiso carries the mustard seed. In the Soto Zen lineage, there are four main bodhisattvas. Three of them we tend to see on the altar all the time. There's Manjushri over there, who often, especially in Japan in the Soto Zen temples, he's riding a lion, looking pretty comfortable on his lion, and he is waving his sword. And then there's Samanabhadra, who's the embodiment of great activity. Samanabhadra's riding an elephant, looking completely confident to go anywhere and do anything. And of course, there's Kuan Yin, or Kanon Avalokiteshvara, with their 1,000 arms that have either an eye, an ear, or some kind of tool or instrument to be able to take care of whatever comes their way. So they're, in a way, they're kind of superheroes, fantastical beings or archetypes that we aspire to. We aspire to great wisdom, great activity, and great compassion. Great, capital G, also could mean something like pure, meaning totally unimpeded by our self-centered ideas and way of being. It's idealized in a way, although we all have moments of behaving in those ways, of acting in those ways. It's not the only place that we live in our lives. Jiso Bodhisattva doesn't appear on altars for the most part, maybe a little family altar, but not in a temple like some great being. Jiso Bodhisattva is usually, I think almost always, portrayed, and statues are made of Jiso as a child or a young person in ordinary monk's clothes, usually looking very sweet and welcoming and innocent, almost naive, and upbeat, positive, curious, like someone that you might pass on the street, someone that you might have been at one point in your life, someone in whom you already embody the qualities of Jiso Bodhisattva. The sutra that Jiso's life or embodiment is based out of is written in 6th century in India. And its basic premise is that the power of devotional commitment can transform any act of karma or misfortune or difficulty in a person's life. Devotional commitment is at the heart of this sutra. It's called the Sutra of the Past Lives of the Earth Store or Earth Womb Bodhisattva. So past lives means that it's about bodhisattvas before the bodhisattva, like those seeds that are within us to become a bodhisattva are these stories. And it was originally told, presumably, by Shakyamuni himself, although it took 6 centuries plus to record it, so who knows exactly. But the story was told upon Shakyamuni hearing that his mother, when he was Siddhartha, his mother died in childbirth. And it's upon hearing or realizing that his mother had arrived in heaven that he told this story, which recounts these three people's pre-bodhisattva's path to becoming the Earth Store or Earth Womb Jiso Bodhisattva. And those stories, particularly the ones that told more often, is about a great devotional act. In this case, it's about a young woman whose mother had lived a life that was less than virtuous. She had abused the three treasures. She'd eaten meat. She hadn't really lived a good Buddhist life. And the daughter worried that she would be reborn in some kind of hell realm. And caring very deeply that her mother not suffer further injuries in her life, she prayed devoutly. She made offerings at stupas. She lit incense. She did everything that she possibly could, kind of endlessly, relentlessly. And finally, out of the agony of wondering what really happened to her mother, she herself makes the journey down to the entranceway of the many different hell realms that exist in this lavish Mahayana sutra. And she's greeted there by someone who says, hears her agony and says, well, let me investigate, let me find out what happened to your mother, and tells her that not only she, but many other beings have been reborn in heavenly realms, that the daughter's devotional acts have made that possible. The importance of this sutra, you know, this can sound maybe kind of odd from the way we usually talk about Buddhism. Maybe I should make an aside as I'm looking at your faces and say, the hell realms, or these realms, are part of the 6 realms that we all transmigrate in, that we don't all reside in one place or another place. We're not all always in heaven, and we're not always in the hungry ghost realm, or the animal realm, or the human realm, or the hell realm, but we're constantly moving depending upon our acts and depending upon our mind states. So when I'm talking about these realms, I'm really alluding to them in that way. The messages of this sutra are that a kind of devotion that one has, like they might have for a cherished parent, or someone who has done deep good for them in their life, can change the karma of that person. Not just for that person, but our acts can have effect on many different people. And also, I think, I didn't go into detail, but there are innumerable numbers of terrifying sounding hell realms that, with all kinds of disgusting things that happen there. And that points to the ways in which our minds can, at times, take us to all kinds of miserable places that we suffer in. And that it is possible through our acts of devotion, of commitment to practice, to transform those. So I just want to go back. You may have noticed I said the name of the sutra is the Earth Store, or the Earth Womb Bodhisattva. The name in Sanskrit for Jiso is Kisatagarbha, which means Earth Store or Earth Womb. I think that's very important to understanding who Jiso is and what Jiso's energy is about. The earth nurtures all life. From the very first cells that formed on this planet Earth, and the first organisms to appear, to everything that has evolved here, including each of us, the earth is what allows us all to flourish. The earth is also the ground on which we stand, a place in which all life unfolds. It's the through line of activity, and it's the realm of impermanence, the realm of constant change of life and death. Fundamentally, the earth endows the web of life of which we are all a part and intimately connects us. It is the foundation for Indra's net. You know, the idea of Indra's net, the interconnectedness between all of us, you move one part of it and it all moves. That's the earth's gift to us. Store or womb is the treasure trove, the earth's treasure for all life. And Jiso then is the conveyor of this treasure trove. Jiso isn't just one-dimensional. Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara may form the two wings of practice, wisdom and compassion. Jiso's got a lot of different things going for them. Qualities that we have, And they're a hallmark, I think, of what brings many of us to practice. Benevolence, determination, optimism, and fearlessness. Benevolence is rather like Dogen's magnanimous mind, always available, an abundance to offer, a place of safety and welcome, well-meaning friendliness. If you've seen images of Jiso, you know that she carries a staff. She walks with rings on it, and as the staff hits the ground, the rings rattle so that no animal is surprised or scared by Jiso's arrival. Even the thumping of the staff against the ground causes vibrations, so snakes and other sound-sensitive or vibration-sensitive animals know how to move. Jiso's considering everyone. Jiso's the manifestation of the second pure precept, to do all that is good. Not out of effort, but really because that's how Jiso is, to just do good, to just expect good and to do good. The earth is rather like this too. The quality of the earth does not judge who comes to it for help. It does not pick and choose which seeds it nurtures. It continues to be generative, no matter what the circumstances. A forest fire may rage through, but eventually new life will come and a new forest will grow. A great lake that once caught fire, given half a chance, could restore its ecosystem and full life again. Earth is generative. That's Jiso's energy. It also receives indiscriminately. Water doesn't pick and choose where it will, rain doesn't pick and choose where its water will fall, and the earth doesn't pick and choose whether or not to absorb it. Seed grows where it falls. That's Jiso's activity. Universal friendliness, openness, and a sense of abundance. Jiso's also known for fierce determination. I used to hang out a lot on the Cornell Ornithology webcam. I don't know if anyone here likes birds, but I spent quite a bit of time really in awe of Big Red, the red-tailed hawk, who was there in the early years of that cam, watching her sit on her clutch of eggs when a freak, then, March snowstorm covered her in snow, and she sat through the night on her clutch, waiting for morning and relief by her partner. It's that kind of fierce determination is bodhisattvas. It's that it comes from almost an unconscious, it comes from a place that's preconceptual. It's just intuitive, this activity, that you're going to stay on your nest, that you're going to, thinking of your mother in some dire state, that you'll move towards doing whatever is necessary in order to respond. just like we just chanted, Mother, at the risk of her own life, watches over and protects. This is the fierce determination of Jiso Bodhisattva. That determination also has in it an endurance, a willingness to keep going, no matter how many periods of Zazen you sit, over how many years, in order to free up some mind states. I remember when I started in the Vipassana tradition and I sat one 30-day retreat where every single period I sat down, I had an ice pick in my shoulder. Both of my parents had just died, and the grief was intolerable, and it manifested as terrible physical pain. Every single period I kept sitting, that ice pick appeared. I sat through it somehow, at some point, it went away. But it's that kind of determination. It's like the godwit who flies 7,000 miles without stopping on its migration path. That's the path of a bodhisattva. So. And then there's patience. Patience, my teacher defined patience as not being unsettled by circumstances. It doesn't matter if there's a snowfall. It doesn't matter what the latest world event was. It doesn't matter. What matters is what's inside you, what your inmost request and call is, and where you want to go. Any rights that have been won in this country have come from patient endurance over a long period of time to actualize them. Not thinking about the results, but focused always on the vow, and acting from a place of where it matters. My very first Zen teacher was a woman named Maylee Scott. She was a peace activist. And during one of the Iraq wars, there were people who were going to sit for peace. And she was at the bulletin board where, back in the days where we had bulletin boards to announce things, she was at the bulletin board where the sign up was for people to go to this sit-in, if you will. And someone came up to her and said, "Do you really think that's going to make any difference?" And she turned and looked at him with a big, big smile and said, "I don't know, but it's most important that I do it." That's Jiso's energy. Jiso also, his third quality, is unflagging optimism. Not jaded or childlike, but just not childlike, but not jaded or disillusioned. Not naive exactly, but not bothered or conditioned by ideas of what can and cannot be. Anything is possible. Karma can turn on a dime. Embodied in that is a joyful mind, a mind that trusts and supports in what the Dharma says. It's being aligned with the Dharma, like doing something that's meaningful or aligns with your values. Maybe like coming here on a Saturday morning to be with each other. Something that comes from deep faith or trust. Or maybe it's just like being free from all your worries about yourself or your ideas. Like after you've finished all your work, you've turned off your devices, and you're going away on vacation. Right? You become no one for a few moments anyway. Supported by the Dharma means accepting things as they are, whatever they are, and believes in the power of action to make change, or at least in its ability to heal. The highest quality of Buddha, if I can, maybe because I relate to this, and maybe like you, like me, when you first heard the Heart Sutra and were chanting and memorizing it, the line, "When the mind is no hindrance, no fears exist," was really catching. Like, how can that be? What does that mean? Jiso Bodhisattva is known most for her quality of fearlessness. Fearlessness is also one of the four methods of a bodhisattva's guidance, according to Dogen. There's kind speech, there's giving the Dharma, material aid, there's identity action, meaning acting as if there's no self and object, just acting as one. But what really caps all of these, or allows all of these to manifest fully, is a sense of fearlessness. And that is a deep and abiding trust in the reality of things as they are, over and above anything else. And that is what Jizo's fearlessness is based on. It's not the emptiness of an insubstantial self, although that may be what the Heart Sutra is pointing to. For me, that can feel kind of abstract in a way, and kind of cool, even though it's worthwhile to study it as such. But really, it lies in Jizo's understanding of boundlessness, sometimes the other side of how shunyata, or emptiness, is translated. The boundlessness of all things. It's like Walt Whitman's phrase, that I am multitudes, that Jizo trusts that we each are, that it is, that the reality of things is multitudes, all co-created, abundant, and unfolding just as they should be. Now that's kind of a stretch, but unfolding just as they should be. Being human means having a life that has suffering. It has both the kinds of suffering that are born from our own karma, greed, hate, and ignorance. The kinds that are inherent in having a body and a physicality of what it means to have a body. And in living in a world where other humans who are doing their best and just mess up or act in ignorant ways, ways that can be based on perpetuating historical, cultural, and generational karma. Pema Chodron says that the real courage is being free of self-deception, being able to look the world in the eye and say, oh yes, that's that. Being able to look myself in the eye and say, oh, all of that, all of that. A bodhisattva's shields, Jizo's shields, are not a sword or an elephant or a bunch of tools and hands. They're just simply vow and a trust in the Dharma. And that's what we all can have. Trust in the Dharma doesn't mean that something unpleasant, dangerous, or devastating won't happen in our lives. Being a Buddhist or a sincere practitioner or a good person certainly doesn't insulate us or inoculate us from those realities. But it does mean that if we step foot off the 100-foot pole of our life, and we can act as we're best called to do. And that is, if you will, our transformation. This is what makes Jizo so amazing, that with faith and determination, kindness and vow, he or she is fearless, even when she's afraid. So the ground of Restore Bodhisattva's activity was her vow, her deep motivation. Suzuki Roshi said it's most important to know what your inmost request is. Everyone here have some sense of that, or have thought about the thing that brings you to practice, the thing that matters the most to you, not your job or your car or your kid. Well, some of those things are very important, but it's really what matters to you about how you live your life, how you know your life to be authentically motivated. And I think a kind of touchstone for that is that when you touch into that, you don't become revved up. You become kind of calmed down and peaceful, grounded. My teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman, used to say, regulate your life. He meant pay attention to what's important to you and do just that. He said in his early his early practice life, he would watch Suzuki Roshi every day. He'd get up, put on his robes, go offer incense, make some bows, and sit down. He did it day after day after day. And yet he had a creative, fresh energy about how he did it. Sojin said it was amazing. I'd never seen anyone do something like that. They were always having different experiences, but here he's doing the same thing over and over again. Regulate your life means to know the ground you stand on, the place that you act from. It creates a container for anything that comes up. It's a way of being and understanding of life that makes it very simple and straightforward, even when the activity around us is very complex. A kind of, what else would I be doing in this situation? Mei Li would go off to another protest. The Tenzo on the hot hill in China, as Dogen was watching, would continue to pick mushrooms because it was just for him to do. Jiso is portrayed often holding a clear ball, a wish-fulfilling jewel. Commonly, that's thought of the wishes that he's bestowing upon all of those who invoke their name for when they're in need. But another way of seeing this clear, wish-fulfilling gem is really Jiso's vow, offering and sharing their vow with anyone who calls upon them. Jiso's work is everywhere. There are Jiso's for every circumstance. Once I think Chosen Bay's book has a list of hundreds of different Jiso's. There are Jiso's for fishermen on the open sea, for farmers dependent on the mercurial and unpredictable weather, for any travelers on any of life's journey. There are Jiso's for patients when they receive the news that they have maybe a few days to a week to live. And Jiso's for the physician who sits at the bedside and has to give them that news. There are Jiso's for the middle school child who's acting out and angry and tells his teacher that he's being abused at home. There are Jiso's for the teacher who has to respond. There are Jiso's everywhere for every circumstance, relying on these qualities of unflagging optimism, determination, kindness, and a lot of fearlessness in those cases. There are Jiso's particularly for women, women wishing children, women struggling in childbirth, women who miscarry for stillbirths, and for all children, for anyone who's sick or in despair. Jiso is there for all of us. In Japan, if anyone here has ever been to Japan or seen pictures of Japan, Jiso's everywhere, literally on the street, not as a child walking along it, but as statues, often in little huts, handmade wooden huts. It's kind of like a lending library that you see on the street, except there's a Jiso inside and it's open. People can make offerings and leave them there. Jiso has his little garb on. Sometimes people will make something and dress him. There are Jiso's at crossroads, Jiso's at temples, Jiso's in front of people's house. You walk down the street and the energy of Jiso is omnipresent. And then if you were to go into a cemetery, you would see oftentimes many Jiso's also, often very cheerfully adorned. Jiso's specialty is grief. It was grief that motivated her in the first place to set on this journey, to find a way to help not only her mother, but to help herself resolve the depth of her grief. Grief was her strong motivation. Jisō's specialty is turning towards grief and moving through it, accepting what is unacceptable, letting in that which we don't want to have happened. It's a fundamental part of accepting the reality of things as they are. All kinds of things I don't want to have happened, or all kinds of things I wish to have happened. But the losses incurred in a human life are really high up on the list. These are the five remembrances. So Jisō is like a five remembrances bodhisattva. From a Pali Sutra, five remembrances say, this is what happens to all human beings. And I realize I didn't tell the story of Kisatagami at the beginning, I meant to. So Kisatagami, is probably there are a few people here who don't know that story. So Kisatagami was, you may know the name because we chant her in at least one version of the women's lineage. She became an ancestor, but she was a common woman and had a child who died. And she went around her village, around her town, crying and bereft, pulling her hair out like a mad woman, begging anyone that she passed up close to please help. Please bring my child back to life. Surely there must be something that you can do. People felt sympathy, but they didn't know what to do. They turned away. She spiraled into almost madness when she came upon the Buddha and stood before the Buddha, here, save my child. And with great sympathy and kindness, he says, good woman, please go and find from one of these houses in your town a mustard seed from a home where no one has experienced loss, and I will be able to revive your child. And of course she came back with no mustard seed, but with the understanding that what had happened to her, great tragedy as it was what happens to all of us. The five remembrances are then that we are, each of us is, made of the substance that will get sick, we'll get old, we'll die, and that will happen to everyone that we care about. It's kind of a bummer, right? But it's true. And that question about, so what about that? How do I live with that? How do I make sense of that? That's Jisō Bodhisattva's work. Jisō is the earth store bodhisattva. The earth knows that everything is always creating new life. Everything is always composting. Each inhalation is coming to life. Each exhalation is letting go or dying. Everything that we do is a beginning and an ending. And the ending is in the beginning, and the beginning is in the ending. This really is the heart of Jisō Bodhisattva's wisdom, a deep, kind understanding that that is the reality of a human life. In every death and every loss, there is another side, of course. All maybe had the breakup that was the breakup to end all breakups where you couldn't imagine ever loving again, for example, only to find that something different, maybe deeper, richer, unimagined, might be possible. Maybe not. But we all have the experience of losing and with time finding something else that takes its place. In the Buddha Dharma, everything contains its opposite. You can't have day without night. You can't have birth without death. Whatever the sadness and loss, there's always another side. New life, new possibility. What is now is completely dependent upon what came before. We would not be here, sitting as we were, if it were not for many other efforts, innumerable, that have come before us. So it is this that is Jizo Bodhisattva's optimism. Optimistic as new life is as spring coming, or maybe even as blossoms as they fall. This is painful at times in our personal lives, but trusting this and knowing this, I think, is how we get through. Later this afternoon, for those of you who can, we're going to do a Jizo ceremony. The Jizo ceremony was begun, as I understand it, in the form that we do it now, after World War II. Japan was devastated by a loss of identity, superiority, the reign of the emperor. It was occupied. People had been evaporated. Tens of thousands of people had been evaporated by atomic bombs. Talk about feeling vulnerable. And many women in the late 40s and 50s had stillbirths, miscarriages, malformed children. Many people, children, died of malnutrition. And so it was a really difficult time, and the levels of grief were really high. That's the ground of this ceremony that we'll be doing today. That background is a container for that kind of grief. So in this ceremony, Jizo accompanies everyone. And although I think it's often done primarily to honor and recognize the struggles of children, particularly those who are not here for whatever reason, Jizo accompanies everyone. A friend who's struggling with mental illness, someone you know who's gotten a serious diagnosis, someone who's grieving terribly, those whose lives are entangled by systemic injustice, the earth, the very earth itself on the species of it, on it. Jizo, Earth Store, Bodhisattva accompanies all of those, all species. So I'll say, for those of you who are thinking of coming and not sure, it's a very simple, beautiful ritual. We come and gather really in stillness and silence together. Perhaps say something about why we've come, perhaps not. We invoke Jizo's presence. And then we work together quietly, making something to clothe Jizo. It might be a scarf, a cap. We'll have to be great at crafting to do this. Scissors and a little imagination is all it takes. And then we offer this. We dress Jizo, make our offering, and we write a prayer and progress out to the area where the Jizo garden will be dedicated at some point, and put our prayers on the wind. So please come if you're interested. No preparation is needed. And feel the energy of Jizo Bodhisattva. Probably I allow some time for questions, or comments, or rebuttals, or reactions, or your own experiences, being with Jizo, needing Jizo. Really appreciate your attention and your interest, and welcome anything that you'd like to say. Yes,
thank you. Thank you, Anya. I just wanted to say, when you talk about the Jizo's coming from the earth, I think about Buddha's touching the earth, Buddha. And then also the Jain people, don't they have or at least the monks have a staff that has a little sound on it that warns mm-hmm. off? Mm-hmm. Is there any way that might have come from the Jain people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that about the Jain's practice. Maybe someone else here knows that.
I don't know which came first, but the Jains are also about, you know, non-harming. They strain their water. They try to avoid killing any being as much as possible. So for them, it's keeping, making a signal so that creatures will disperse. So it's a similar vow or energy, I think.
Of course, you have to be careful where you put your stick down. Yeah, please.
I was wondering if you could speak about the quality of fearlessness while being afraid.
We're always going to have emotions. That's just part of being a human being. Going to have fear when it comes up, especially in some really fearful circumstances. The lion is charging you, or you're about to be hit by a car, or something like that. The fearlessness is the ground of trust to face it in the best way you can. Like the strawberry in the story of the monk who's hanging off the side of the cliff, and there's a lion below, or tiger below, and a tiger above, and there's a strawberry. It's like that. Yes, please.
I have a little two comments and then a question. Your talk reminded me of, because you said you came from the Vipassana tradition originally. So your talk, I was at a music festival in Rajasthan a number of years ago. I avoided you doing that. And there was sort of, I guess you'd call an MC, who was saying, you know, very gently, please turn off your phones and blah, blah, blah. Like a very standard announcement, but it was delivered in what was for me as an American a very non-standard way. And I feel that the gentleness with which you were delivering your talk reminds me of that. Mm-hmm. And the gentleness to me is the teaching itself. Even if I did not understand anything you were saying, mm-hmm. that to me is the teaching. Mm-hmm. And it's very beautiful. Yeah. You also made me think of Maya Angelou, who said that courage is the greatest of the virtues. Mm-hmm. Because without courage, you cannot practice any other virtue consistently. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of echoing that. And then I was thinking about, my question is, because I feel, I sort of, you know, as you were speaking, I understood and felt the jizo within myself. But I also feel, unfortunately, you know, for me, I'm sure for others, the shadow energy is over ambition, tenacity, you know, wanting. And how do you have that sort of, how do you sustain a generous, benevolent endurance without allowing that shadow energy to enter? If that
makes sense. Really great question. You know, I think the turning for me in my understanding is it's not about me and what I'm doing. And in fact, I myself, whatever I do is dependent on the acts and works of so many other people. My job is to do my part. It's not about me and what I'm doing. It's just about the act itself and trusting in that co-creation. And I find that whatever arises, whatever I'm able to do, is so much bigger and more effective, usually, than what I would have come up with on my own. So I can give an example from my own life. I'm a palliative medicine physician. So that means I'm always working with people who are on the downhill slope of their life, in the position of talking with them about things that really matter and are really difficult. If I went in thinking that I was somehow supposed to help out and make it better, that would be a big problem, because I don't really know the depth of their experience, where they are, how they'll respond. My job is to move with and to listen deeply and to trust. Whatever happens comes out of their own wisdom, actually. And by skillful questions and guidings, I can help support that. So that's really how I've come to understand this, that I have to use a lot of life determination and energy, we all do, in what we do. but it's not about me. It's freely given. Does that help?
My understanding of what you're saying, if I can email down that, is that we are all doing our part, and it is best to listen and kind of go with the flow.
Something else my teacher used to say was dig deeper. When things are really tough, I should be doing something here. I don't know what to say. Oh, this is really hard. To drop the energy down as practitioners, I can say, into your hara, into your breath. Really come to that deep place and not know and trust that something will come. If the energy of our emotions can settle down, something else will arise up. Anyone else have anything? Please.
If things unfold just as they should, then why work for change?
That's great. Because they wouldn't unfold as they should if you didn't. Things unfold as they, maybe should isn't quite the right word, but something like that. Nothing is ever out of place. Everything is unfolding according to all the causes and conditions that came before. Our actions are part of the causes and conditions of the next moment. Please.
Yeah, that just reminds me of the fifth remembrance about something like our actions are the ground on which we stand.
That's right. The only possession we have, so to speak, is our actions, our volitional actions. Everything else belongs to everyone. Other thoughts? Reactions? Please.
Yeah, what would be your advice just of practice for like a beginner? Because I don't feel like, I feel like endless compassion for all sentient beings is not necessarily a natural thing to occur. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier to not feel that way. And I don't feel like, awakening to your true nature, the non-duality of the universe and all that, that can help trigger compassion. At the same time, it can be a little bit theoretical and not necessarily imply that you should act in a certain way towards your neighbor or when you're driving your car. Mm-hmm. What would be your kind of advice to somebody in just increasing and growing that compassion that we all should be feeling?
Yeah, great. A really great question. I think start like Restore Bodhisattva did. Start by generating compassion for someone who has been important to you, someone who has your unconditional respect in life. There is a practice called the metta practice, which some of you may know, not really so much a Soto Zen thing, but something that we certainly do. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, the
metta phrases are to start with particularly someone with whom it's really easy to feel loving kindness or generative well-being, and to offer them phrases. The standard phrases are, may you know loving kindness, may you be peaceful and at ease, may you be free from suffering, may you be happy, or some version of that that feels what comes naturally to you, and really to sit with those phrases and offer them up. And then there are other level or other people that you can offer to. Often people can be beings also, that range from someone that you care about but maybe you don't have unconditional regard for, someone you feel absolutely neutral for, and someone with whom you really have difficulty. And of course yourself gets put in there. Sometimes at the beginning, I think a lot of people find that difficult, so it's usually the second object. And it's kind of amazing what that does, I can say out of my own experience practicing with metta.
I have a question. We hear so much about, speaking of compassion, we hear so much about the Bodhisattva of compassion. and relatively little about Jiso. And I wonder if it's useful or helpful at all if you might explore some of the varying spheres or roles of Jiso and Avalokiteshvara. Because as I heard your talk and appreciated the talk, I thought, wait, which one are we talking about now?
Great. Could everyone hear that question?
Yeah.
Gosh, the acoustics here are really marvelous. So I think Avalokiteshvara is kind of the idealized idea of compassion. 1,000 arms, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 ears, no matter what the circumstances, there is an instant readiness and knowing what to do that is great or perfect or purified, always on target. Jiso is kind of more like you and me. Jiso is doing their best to be kind and benevolent and welcoming and present. A little different than being able to affect change for someone in the moment, being able to dispel all difficulty out of her kindness. Jiso is more someone who's like us. I think of Jiso as a really good friend, someone who's totally there, believes in us. I'm stretching it a little bit, but if I think your question resonates that way for me. Jesus on the ground with us in our daily life, bringing us back to the reality of our lives. Avalokiteshvara maybe transcends our life, but we're here living in the muck of the reality of birth and death. And that's a little different point of view than Avalokiteshvara, who's acting out of emptiness, if you will. I don't know if anyone else, George, you want to say anything about that?
You've said so much that's so great and brought forward so many wonderful comments. I think I agree, just having come from Japan, actually, that Jiso really is omnipresent, and armies of Jisos, really. The first park we went to, the first night we arrived, we were all exhausted, but we walked through this aisles and rows of Jisos that all had been given something to wear and a little whirligig. It was turning, I mean a real one that was turning in the wind. And it's everywhere, as you say. So very near, and you can bring anything to Jiso. I think the idea of Kuan Yin is like this embodiment of pure compassion. It's a little, that was good. Not so intimate in some ways.
Yeah. Not down in the mud with us.
Mm-hmm.